Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Farmer, and today I'm joined by Tieko Tsotse. Tieko, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good things, and how are you, Nick, sir?
I'm very good, thank you. And of course, we are also joined once again today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, welcome back.
Hello, Nicholas. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Hello,
Tieko. Right. Let's get started today with the big news, I think, that all of the sort of mainstream is following today, and that is, according to some sources in government, the Gupta brothers have finally been arrested. So the Gupta brothers, that is Atul and Rajesh Gupta, who have been on the run from South African authorities for a while. According to some sources within the Justice Department, have allegedly been arrested by the United Arab Emirates Police. The Ministry of Justice and Correctional Services confirms it has received information from law enforcement authorities in the United Arab Emirates, UAE, that fugitives of justice, namely Rajesh and Atul Gupta, have been arrested. Discussions between various law enforcement agencies in the UAE and South Africa on the way forward are ongoing. The South African government will continue to cooperate with the UAE. They are specifically wanted for a case relating to procurement fraud involving 25 million rand in the Free State. The money was apparently paid by the Free State Department of Agriculture to a company that then transferred the money to the Guptas illegally. Allegedly illegally, the Gupta brothers left SA in April of 2016, days after they and Dudizana Zuma resigned from the board of Bay Resources and Energy Company. They apparently left with an enormous amount of luggage in a private jet from Lanseria Airport. And they have been the focus, as I'm sure everyone listening to this knows, of much scrutiny and blame for the destruction of state institutions that occurred in the 2010s. And so I'm sure that some people are going to be claiming this as a big win in the fight against corruption. Presumably they are going to at some point be extradited to South Africa now that they have been arrested. There was an Interpol red notice put out for them, which I believe the Dubai authorities acted on. So, Terence, let me start with you. I think this, we can all agree this is a good thing. The question is, how good of a thing? Is this going to change the fight against corruption? Is this going to be an opportunity for Ramaphosa to claim that he is defeating the agents of state capture? What do you make of all this?
Well, my first question, I think this is an important one. If they get flown back to South Africa, they're going to land at Waterkloof again. But, I think, that aside, my understanding is that two of the brothers, not the third one, have been arrested. I'm intrigued as to why this is the case. I think it's also interesting because remember in 2018, there was a South African businessman who accosted one of the Gupta brothers in Dubai and shook his hand and did a video taken. He got arrested by the authorities that side. So it seems that some sort of worm has turned, which is interesting. And they've been on that red notice for a long time, and it's not like they've been sort of living undercover or anything. I mean, there's no fake wigs or moustaches or, assumed identities. Right. See, it's kind of Dubai, like everyone knew exactly where they could go.
Or where Dubai is not Shanghai. You know, it's not the biggest, it's not a massive, massive city. It's a big place, but it's not a tiny place.
So, something must have happened. And I think it's great that we are in a situation now where it looks like there is some prospect of people being held to account for what is alleged of them. That's always very important. My question, though, is, does this become the big media circus that obscures everything else? Is this the dubbed soundtrack that we all listen to while the real story kind of fades into the background? And, in a way, if everything alleged about the Guptas is true, they were brazen and they were venal, but there is a certain extent to which you can sate that, and you know you can walk away from that. They seem to be after stealing money and opportunities. It was the people who sold out the South African state and the country's institutions that did the real harm. It's interesting for those who read the Daily Friend. I think coming on Friday we'll be looking at lessons for South Africa from Indonesia and Vietnam. And this was a big problem with Indonesia, it grew very, very nicely for a number of decades. But when it faced challenges like in the oil shocks in the 80s or in the Asian financial crisis, you had this big patronage network that didn't want to let go, and that caused them a great deal of trouble. And I think South Africa is in very much the same situation.
Yeah, just as an aside on that point, I actually, when I was much younger, traveled to Indonesia a couple of years after the Asian financial crisis, and the capital city Jakarta was filled with half-finished buildings and construction projects that just ran out of money. And you could really, I was too young at the time to understand it, but thinking back, I don't think I've ever seen such a immediate, sudden evidence of toxic policy and patronage, the damage it can do to an economy, because you could see the physical shells of the stalled economy all around you, which is quite something.
Yeah, you know, look, one of the points about that is that the sort of second Indonesian president, Suharto, he had managed, although he was at the center of all of this, he had also managed to sort of hold it at a level where it wasn't debilitating until it became debilitating, until the 1980s, where greed just kind of took over and went insane. But, you know, there again, they've also got things we don't. They've got oil and they've got, you know, 280 million people. You know, you've got a big market and, you can sort of carry on your own steam. South Africa, we actually need things like institutions.
No, definitely. Although, unlike them, we at least don't have major religious conflict, which is one thing we can say the slice of them. So Tieko, Terence mentioned this, you know, the real problem with the Gupta brothers was not necessarily that they were, the media, they've described them as buying the country, right? They bought the president, they bought the institutions of state. But those institutions should never have been for sale in the first place. And I think that once again, you know, in pinning all the blame on them, there's a temptation very much to kind of suggest that the Guptas were the problem rather than the politicians who sold out to them. And so I want your thoughts on that. And also I see in the comments, one of our listeners is suggesting fairly cynically that perhaps the reason that this has happened now is because Cyril Ramaphosa is in trouble and this is sort of his ace up his sleeve to distract the public and remind everyone that he is the fighter of state corruption. So, what do you make of all that? Your thoughts on this, Tieko?
Well, I think let me start with the second comment. I think this is a story that has been building for a while now. And so I don't think we can really pin it to what happened over the revelations of last week around Cyril Ramaphosa. You know, this is a process that's been ongoing for a while. And I think it's a good thing that we are where we are, whereby two Gupta brothers have been arrested. But no, I entirely agree with you, Nick. I think at the center of the corruption crisis in South Africa are the politicians. Business people and ordinary people and your tenderpreneurs cannot go into government, for example, for the government to give them tenders and stuff. But politicians have been at the center, right? Politicians have been interfering in daily operations of departments, state-owned entities, forcing administrators to give businesses to these people, forcing administrators to employ certain people and stuff. And so if we are serious about tackling corruption in South Africa, we really must run after people like the Guptas, but we really, 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 really must run after the politicians. They are at the very core and at the very center of the crisis that we find ourselves in South Africa.
That's exactly, I think, you know, what's important about the Zondo Commission is that it laid out a lot of you know, how specifically the Guptas interact with these politicians. And so if we don't see proper, speedy prosecutions of the people implicated in those reports, a lot of this is fairly hollow. I see also in the comments the suggestion that we need to get the assets back, and that's a really big part of this. Terence, do you think there's any possibility that we're going to get any of the stolen stuff back?
I think people like smart enough to defraud an entire country if we're smart enough to hide it. But you know, I think yes, there is a possibility, but you know, it's probably been like offshored and offshored from offshores and whatever. So I think that's a tough one. But I think that it's important to bear in mind that it's not just the sort of commandeering of assets, isn't, you know, like a you know, bunch of money or company shares or whatever. It's the destruction of value and confidence that goes with it. So those assets, you know, assets that that they may have sunk money in may not be worth anything.
Right. I want to give a great example of that that I've heard of. So I believe this is alleged, but I'm pretty sure it's true. And this is apparently some of the damage done. One of the reasons that some of the Eskom power stations have been having a lot of problems is not just because of poor maintenance, because they're old and such, because allegedly Gupta-aligned companies were given contracts to sell coal to these power stations, and they sold them very substandard quality coal, and that damaged the machinery. And so that's exactly what you're talking about there. We had this asset, and due to the corruption involved here, it's now worth less, and it's causing us problems in other parts of the economy.
Yeah, I know. It's dreadful.
Indeed it is. But, you know, hopefully we can see at least some of that returned. And, you know, I'm sure not everyone who deserves to go to jail is going to go to jail. But at least if someone who deserves to go to jail goes to jail, that's a good thing. So
that would be a good thing.
All right, let's move on.
Let's go to jail.
There you go. All right, let's move on to our next story. This is about a terrible incident that's been captured on film at Home Affairs. Apparently, a 40-year-old priest was left injured after he tried to get something sorted out at Home Affairs. He says that he was assaulted and his life was threatened by staff of this Home Affairs office. So Matenza Gingele said he and his wife flew from East London in the Eastern Cape to inquire about an application he had made following his sister's passing. I think he was trying to sort out something to do with her death certificate. He said, "We requested to see officials who came to help with the intervention on services. I tried in East London and never got anywhere, after I applied for this document in January of 2021. The security told me I'd be helped by one official, but we waited. When we complained about not getting any attention, the officer said she won't help us, so we walked further into the building to look for someone to give us some help. The lady then pulled me by the shirt, and another male one came and helped me by my shirt chest. I held his shirt, and some shirts were ripped. A video emerged of this incident of Gengela being dragged by two people through the building as he was lying flat on his back on the ground out of an office. He claims that he was then taken to a dark room by some of the staff there. He says about six or seven people then kicked him, dragged him to a dark passageway, and they put a knee on his chest and strangled him, saying they were going to kill him. They pulled him back to the driveway, held him on the ground while kicking him in the sides. And then eventually, apparently, a policewoman came and told him that he would be arrested and that they were right to beat him. He says he felt humiliated in front of his wife. And he went to the police station to open a case against, in fact, in this case, the Minister of Home Affairs. And apparently there, he once again received a sort of abuse. The police said, quote, "They called me stupid and told me they would not register a case. And so I left without a case being registered or receiving any answers regarding my applications at Home Affairs." A spokesperson for the Department of Home Affairs said the department has launched a full-scale investigation into the incident, and the department will act guided by the outcome of the investigation. So, you know, investigation is not complete. We don't know entirely what happened here. But I must say, the video evidence at least shows a guy being dragged out of a building who doesn't appear to be thrashing around or resisting. Terence, I think what is horrifying about this story is that it sounds so plausible. Abuse by the civil service is not something that South Africans are unfamiliar with.
Yeah, I know. In South Africa, and this links back to the previous story, we like to talk about corruption because corruption has this moral dimension. Someone stole that, they were dishonest. Far more serious to my mind is the lack of professionalism in the state. Many countries in the world, in which the state plays a very large role in your life, and I'm thinking, East Asia again, they have corruption problems that are, in some ways as bad as ours in terms of, expectations of bribery or whatever. But they also have civil services that within their own logic work quite well. It's about, you put a red envelope on the table and I'll make sure that you get the inspection for your project that you need. I'm not saying it's laudable or it's great, but that is how a lot of these countries function. In our case, it's frequently just non-functioning. Made all the more serious by the fact that you have a sort of stage orientation that it needs to be involved in everything. A foundational document for South Africans is their identity book or their identity card. There was an extreme case about two decades ago where a guy actually took a gun into Home Affairs because he'd been trying to get his ID book for so long and he couldn't apply for a job and he couldn't do this and he couldn't do that. And he, try to get it by force. And I'll tell you, there was an outpouring of sympathy because a lot of people have those sort of experiences. And this is replicated again and again and again to, mining licenses. I think there's also a kind of philosophical thing here that if the state is going to make it, is going to make you jump through particular hoops, it needs to make those hoops as convenient and as efficient as possible. The sense I get, though, is that it's frequently a case of, the state will do what is good for itself, or what is, what is good for its incumbents, and, the rest of us must kind of fit in.
Well, that's very much the case, and I think about how actually this is a problem that really disproportionately affects poor South Africans because they often have to interact with the state in a very intimate way. Mm. Things like SASSA grants and applying for, permits for like RDP houses or whatever, stuff like that often results in people having to stand in long lines and taking abuse from officials like this. Tieko, your thoughts on this? Have you heard any similar stories to abuse like this? What do you make of this?
No, I haven't. I haven't personally had any similar stories to this kind of abuse, but I think that my thoughts are that it's part of our problem as South Africans. I think that we can't carry on the way we've been moving, right? Whereby we elect people into government to govern us. And once after electing them, we don't hold them to account. Part of what I think is necessary in South Africa at this point in time is that we need a strong civil society sector, really, that's going to hold our government to account, workers of the government to account, ensure that the government works in a professional manner. But unfortunately, as things stand, we have a very weak civil society sector at the moment, which really gives the allowance to the government and state employees to do whatever they want to do in government departments, despite the fact that we are the ones paying their salaries. I mean, these people have to respect us. We are the ones who pay their salaries and we should start to hold them to account. We really need to build a strong civil society organization so these guys start working and taking their jobs seriously. We must hold them to account.
I agree with that. So much of South Africa has become this kind of, the expectations are so low that government doesn't even feel the pressure to work. I'm sure anyone who's interacted with the police, and that's another part of the story that I think is familiar, of a guy trying to open a case at the police station, he doesn't know maybe what the exact best legal way to open the case is. He wants to go up to the Minister of Home Affairs for this abuse. But, the police call him stupid and laugh at him. And I heard much more horrifying stories about of this nature, but usually related to people, and who have endured rape or sexual assault, where it's very similar things have happened. The police kind of just dismiss their charges. And I think part of it is just that South Africans do not expect better. And we just sort of shrug our shoulders and say, oh, it's just a Monday. It's just a Tuesday. This is what happens. Terence, any final thoughts?
I think that we are probably going to be stuck in our general malaise, and I mean low growth, frustrated service deliveries, insecurity, until that facet of South Africa gets sorted out, until civil servant, state agencies, and whatever start to function properly, or at least, you know, we hear this phrase good governance. Well, you know, there's an even better one, good enough governance. And that's, you know, you say, well, there's corruption, there's, and this is actually a thing. There's corruption, you know, not everything works properly, but it's okay. If you have to pay 10% to get the contract, but you know, you sort of do the contract properly. Might have to, you know, buy someone a cool drink to get your passport, application, processed, but the passport comes rapidly enough. You know, that'd be better than what we've got.
Indeed. And also to steal from your style, Terence, top tip. It's not great governance to kick someone in the ribs for asking about their documents.
We don't kick people. That's very important.
Yes.
All Daily Friend viewers, we don't kick people.
All right, let's move on to our next story. And this is a very specific aspect. So there is currently a bill which is amending parts of the basic education legal framework. But we're only going to focus on one specific thing from it, and that is the bill that is currently before Parliament looks to loosen regulations on the selling of alcohol on school property. So currently you're not allowed to sell alcohol basically for any reason on school property, even when it's after school hours, even when there's no kids there, even when the selling is being done by adults, even if the school is being rented out to, say, a wedding or a party or something like that. Well, there's a section of the bill that will allow alcohol selling on school premises by adult guests and not pupils during fundraising activities or alternatively related to that, events held on school property. So a lot of schools around the country, it's one of the few sort of cheap public venues, and they might rent out the school hall or something to a wedding or some such thing. So I suspect the idea behind this is really just to give schools a way to raise money more effectively, because they will get more events and be able to make more money if they are selling alcohol, which, of course, can make an enormous amount of money for you. However, some groups such as the Southern Africa Alcohol Policy Alliance have rejected this change to the law very aggressively. They say, we live in a society where we have laws around alcohol. Do people comply with them? No. There is a huge problem around alcohol in our country. We saw it under the COVID-19 and before. There's drunken driving, interpersonal violence that happens because of alcohol, liquor outlets that stay open beyond operating hours. There are all kinds of ways the law is not being observed. There are existing problems in school around alcohol, where teachers come to school drunk, or they drink at school and they go on, I think, to say that this legislation would make these problems worse. So, Tieko, I'm going to start with you. Firstly, what do you make of this law? Obviously, alcohol is a really big problem in our society. We have lots of violence that are alcohol related, lots of crime, alcohol related, lots of deaths, alcohol related. But I feel like this is a little bit like raising the drinking age to 21, which is something some people have suggested. It's not fixing the problem, which is just enforcing the laws we already have, not making new laws. I don't know. What do you make of this, Diego?
Well, I don't think alcohol in and of itself is one of the biggest problems we have in South Africa. I think it's the people who are consuming the alcohol and end up doing things that are not appropriate that are the problem. But my personal opinion is that if schools can use their venues outside, well, when students are not around, can use their venues for other things and raise money in that way through selling of alcohol when students are not around, then they should definitely be given that option. I mean, personally, as a resident, as a taxpayer, I am absolutely tired of high taxes that we pay in South Africa. If there is a way that schools can generate a bit more money, and ultimately that's the point whereby I pay less taxes, for example, that would be good. But I think it's a good law if it's going to generate money for schools without necessarily impacting school lives of students. If students are not there when the alcohol is being sold, I see nothing wrong with that.
Terence, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it's interesting that the people opposing this say that people don't obey the law in South Africa. So you pass a law that they're not going to obey by that logic. I wonder how many schools are actually listening to this anyway. I suspect that it's not going to be too difficult to find a place that you can either school all and, you know, bring in a couple of, you know, doses of vein. Top tip, don't drink dose vein. It's very bad. My view on this is that we need to they should push this through. If you are selling, like, you know, Panther juice to kids or whatever, then you should be put in prison. However, as a fundraising thing, I just think it's standard. And all you will do is, you know, create problems for schools that are trying to, you know, make a bit of extra cash, and, you know, to what real purpose? This doesn't seem to have a sort of rational basis. I think this is the legislative equivalent of virtue signaling.
I think
go ahead, but, you know, once again, to, you know, top tip here, don't give alcohol to minors. Not a good thing.
I agree.
There we go. That's my problem with drinking.
Yeah, I agree entirely with you, Terence, and really there is no logic around this whole argument. And now I'm going back to my argument around not selling around kids and stuff. Of course, I still think that you shouldn't sell around kids. But the thing is that you have kids attending weddings, attending parties where adults are drinking alcohol and stuff. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the kids will end up drinking that alcohol. These kids are raised in communities where alcohol is sold in many of these areas. If you go to township, you go to rural areas, kids are allowed into bottle stores anyway, and still they are kids who don't drink alcohol. So kids being in the presence of adults who drink does not necessarily mean that the kids will end up drinking anyway. I agree that the law must be pushed.
You know, just thinking back to my misspent youth, I think most drinking tended to happen out of the sight and hearing of adults. But then again, you know, strange things happen in this world.
Yeah, I think you guys are exactly right. This is sort of, you know, there's a problem. People are drinking too much. People are stabbing each other while drinking. People are driving drunk. And so we must just oppose every single piece of law that will allow any loosening of any alcohol restriction in any context whatsoever. And that's, I agree with you, Terence. That's really, it is. It's sort of virtue signaling. It's saying, well, we have to take a moral stand rather than actually consider the implications of this law.
Absolutely.
And as you say, you know, the people who are suggesting this, who are opposed to this change to the legislation are saying, no, but no one obeys the law already. Well, then that's the problem, is that we already have laws that no one obeys. Let's just enforce those. And this is a common South African problem, I think, where we're faced with a difficult problem that requires the improvement of institutions, that requires the improvement of the efficiency of institutions. And our response to that is, well, that's kind of difficult and it'll probably upset people because you might have to fire someone, or you might have to change someone's job or whatever. So let's just pass a new law.
You know, I heard a story. I don't know if this is true, but it's plausible. Back in the 80s, concerns about people taking alcohol to sports matches. So there's some talk about prohibiting that. So apparently what some enterprising people were doing was it was injecting vodka into oranges. Don't have that
yeah. No, exactly. If people want to drink, they're probably going to find a way. But anyway, that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much, gentlemen, for appearing on the show. And thank you to everyone for listening. We hope that you found it interesting. And we will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. We hope you all have a wonderful and fantastic day. Cheers, everyone.